Good morning. Greetings to each one here this morning. It's good to be here again. Not sure if my little light works here. Anyway, it's all right. Good to be here again this morning and worship again. And I love spring with everything that it throws at us. And some days the sun shines and we stretch out, feel the warmth of it, and the next day it snows in, and it's a little bit bleak, but it is still, if I was to pick a special time of year, spring would be it. There's a few things about it that I love, and think about the new life. That's probably one of the first things that comes to mind. Creation that comes alive after sleeping in the clutches of ice and snow. There's new calves and babies of all kinds and green grass and budding trees and flowers. There's also hope and there's optimism again. Maybe after the summer, the way it went out with that hailstorm and everything like that, it's good to see springtime and stoke some optimism again. There's the meadowlark on the fence post that sings, and the bald eagles sitting in the trees. But most of all, to remember and celebrate once again the most crucial and earth-shattering event in all of history, that's Easter. I'm not going to preach about Easter this morning, but some things to help spring come alive. And we think of the death and resurrection of Christ and the possibility of the new life available to every person on the face of the earth and the hope of eternal life. For my text this morning, I would like to turn to Matthew 26. There's a part of that would like to read. I was thinking about what to speak on a while back and thinking about the time of year and about the coming Easter season, and I was reading down through this account in my personal devotions one morning, and this story stuck out to me, and I thought I would look at a few things in it. And Matthew 26, I'm going to read it, the account in Matthew, and then I also want to read the account in John, the Gospel of John. Matthew 26, we'll begin in verse 1. And it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, "Ye know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people under the palace of the high priest, who is called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people." Now when Jesus was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, there came unto him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment, and poured it on his head as he sat at meat. And when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, "To what purpose is this waste? This ointment might have been sold for much and given to the poor." When Jesus understood it, he said unto them, "Why trouble ye this woman? For she hath wrought a good work upon me. For ye have the poor always with you, but me ye have not always. For in that she hath poured this ointment on my body, she did it for my burial. Verily I say unto you, wherefore this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this that this woman hath done be told for a memorial of her." And then turn over to John chapter 12. And there is some controversy whether this is the exact same scene. I think it is, from what I can tell from the studies. And the first 11 verses of John 12 says, "Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him. Then took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. Then saith one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him, Why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag and bare what was put therein. Then said Jesus, Let her alone, against the day of my burying hath she kept this. For the poor always ye have with you, but me have not always. Much people of the Jews therefore knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus also to death, because that by reason of him many of the Jews went away and believed on Jesus. The title of this message I've taken out of the first account we read in Matthew, and I know there's a lot of different ways we can go with this story, and I've heard some tremendous messages on it. The title for this message is the question that was asked by the disciples in the 8th verse there. After Mary had come in and had poured the ointment, and they seen it and they recognized what it was, and they said, To what purpose is this waste? That's what I'd like to think about. This act that Mary did was an act of worship. And the effort that she went to get that ointment, they said it would have been approximately 1 year's wages for someone to actually get this ointment. It was so expensive, and the disciples that were there watching it seen it, and they seen it, and they're instead of seeing what she was actually doing and looking beyond, they seen the ointment, they seen the cost, and they said, To what purpose is this waste? Can you imagine? So a little bit of the context here. The plot to betray Christ was already in motion. It was taking shape. Christ and his disciples had disappeared for a while to the city of Ephraim. And after Lazarus was resurrected, there was a lot of tension, and there was a lot of converts, and the Jewish authorities couldn't stand it, and they were hunting for Jesus, so he left. And so Christ had already raised Lazarus, and the Jewish leaders were worried sick that they were going to lose the whole crowd. They seen it happening, and they said, If we don't do something right now, we're not going to have anybody on our side. They're all going to be followers. And their hatred had reached a boiling point, and they were out to get him at all cost. We've seen that in the beginning of this chapter here. They were conniving. And here Christ and his disciples were having lunch with some of their close friends in Bethany at the house, it says, of Simon the leper. And so you think about it. Christ was spending time with his close friends, Lazarus, Mary and Martha were there. Simon, if it is the same account, they're gathered round, and this Martha is serving and doing her thing, and Mary is there, and she comes and she anoints Christ with this precious ointment. And I had to think about it. Can you imagine the content of their conversation as they sat around that table? Christ understanding what was coming, and he was vocal about it. He said, In a couple days, it's going to all be over. And Lazarus sitting there that had been dead 3 days. Imagine the questions you'd have for someone like that. So Mary comes and she anoints Christ with this ointment, and it drew the ire of some of the disciples, but especially Judas. And what I'd like to bring out is the tension between the worldly values of the disciples, followers of Christ, the tension there and the between that and the spiritual values of Mary as she understood what was happening to a point and made this sacrifice. So the tension between the worldly values and the spiritual devotion, the selfishness and selflessness, the secular or the profane and the sacred, that's what I'd like to kind of go through in thinking of it in the sense of worship, the effect that the secular, the profane has on the sacred and the tension that's there, the two mindsets. And we see here in this account, the issue was not the ointment. The issue was not the price. The issue was the intent behind the actions of Mary and the intent behind the questions of the disciples, or Judas. To what purpose is this waste? Christ was sitting there and he's seen right through it all. And we read down through and we see what he has to say about that, where he placed his value. What the disciples, or what Judas offered, you know, as far as giving money to the poor, was not wrong in and of itself. But in the context of what was going on here, it was way out of line. To bring that forward a little bit, we begin to ask some of the same questions when we begin to view life from a secular perspective. When it comes to worship, when it comes to our devotion, how often do we say, to what purpose is this waste? Devoted worship to God does not make sense anymore. When we see that all around us, we see the people that will sit and have a Sunday morning service on their flat screen TV instead of going to church and actually physically being with somebody. That's the new thing. Why would we get up and dress up and show up on time to worship services? To what purpose is this waste? That's what they say. Why would we do the hard work of study and actually contribute to Sunday school and every other part of the service? It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort. You might have to get up early. You might have to stay up late. To what purpose is this waste? It's pretty easy to get there. What about the midweek services? Do we plan for it and quit our work early if necessary? Do we quit our work early if necessary so we can be there, or do we say with our absence, to what purpose is this waste? I'm talking about the secular mindset and having our motives and our intent right. Now I'd like to just flip back a page to Mark chapter 12, sorry. Another account here, it's Christ again, and he's verse 41 to verse 44. And Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he called unto him his disciples, and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow hath cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. This widow here in this story had the exact same mindset as Mary did with that spikenard that she had spent a year working for. She had a sacred mindset. Her intent was the same as Mary's. And when she came in that line to drop in her two little coins that were worth less than half a cent among all those wealthy people, it didn't derail her. She went ahead and she did it. And Christ was sitting back, and it's interesting because he was sitting back and he watched that. He didn't condemn the wealthy people for throwing in, but he said, hey, he took note of that. That little, in the, that there was a big part of her worship and devotion, and it was very real in her life. She was not derailed by the secular, or it didn't make sense. Because from every secular viewpoint, it did not make sense. What difference would two little coins make? I'm going to shift gears here just a little bit. But I thought about it over the years, about the secular and the sacred, and especially this time of year, we start to deal with a tremendous amount of work. There's so much to do, we can't get around. We can't cover all our bases, it seems like, some days. But we take a day off and we come and we worship like we're doing here today, and that is beautiful, and that's the way it's supposed to be. But then do we switch off on Monday morning and we move into our secular setting and we enter into that world and we leave this one behind for 6 days till it comes around again next weekend? And how that balances out with giving Christ first place. And I think too often, and I'm kind of exposing my own way of thinking, but we compartmentalize our work life and our sacred life, whatever that entails. And we act as it's a switch where we turn it off and turn it on. And I would like to talk about our work. And do we as Christians view our work as just secular pursuits? Or does it actually have meaning? Does our work that we do during the week actually have purpose? Is our vocation or our occupation a form of worship? Is it sacred? Can it be? Is there a way to be out there farming and ranching and building and pouring concrete? Is there a way to make that actually an act of worship? I was introduced to an interesting thought a few years back. But the words work and worship actually come from the same Hebrew word. That word is avodah. I think that's how you say it. Avodah in the Hebrew is the word used in Genesis when God planted the garden eastward in Eden, and he put Adam in there, he put humans in there, and he told them to dress it and to keep it. That is the word that is used in the Hebrew for what Adam's responsibility was in the garden. He was to work. He was to work hard. There was, I don't know what that looked like in a perfect garden, but there was, if you study the words, it means tilling and working the ground and tending the vegetation, the plants. But that work was actually a part of the worship that he was engaged in. The word avodah can be translated as work, worship, or service. And I found that interesting because it starts to make sense. And I'm going to try and bring this all back around, but Mary made the decision to purchase that alabaster box of ointment. which in those days costed, like I said, approximately a year of wages. When she decided to do that, can you imagine the purpose in her work, the saving and the sacrifice that she went to actually purchase that? Imagine working for a whole year. The act of worship in anointing Christ with that ointment was just the climax of all the effort it took to purchase it. And I think there's a direct link between her work and her worship. It was all part of it was her life. It was not work over here and worship over here. It engulfed everything about her. I'd like to read in Romans chapter 12. Well, the first verse, I'm sure we all know it. It says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And I'd like to think about that verse, your reasonable service. In the parallel Bible, says it this way. It says, your reasonable service is your rational, logical, intelligent act of worship. And I'd like to keep that in our minds. Our bodies is a living sacrifice. The hard work we do as an act of worship. I thought about Noah, how he presented his body a living sacrifice when he spent 120 years building the ark, preaching to the naysayers. And they were all gathered around saying, for what purpose is this waste? I'm sure he could relate to that. Maybe he even thought it sometimes on the dry land when he was putting his beams and his boards together and was thinking it was going to rain. What he was doing absolutely made no sense to the from the secular perspective. But it did not faze him. There was purpose and there was worship in all that he did. He and his family safely floating through the water, through the storm, and his formal act of worship when he came off the ark after it was all over, was the climax of his effort of those 120 years before. So how do we make our daily work a part of our worship? In all of our work, there can be an element of worship and service depending on our intent. The why behind what we do is what makes all the difference. Then on the flip side, our formal worship can become a profane or a secular performance depending on our intent. It goes both ways. That is where Judas and the Jewish leaders found themselves. Christ and Lazarus had become a threat, and the worship and devotion of Mary made absolutely no sense. And I'd like to point out three ways that we can make our daily work, our mundane jobs, an act of worship. First one I have, work is an act of worship when we view our work as our calling. It's not just a job. We don't just go out and muddle through our days doing half a job when it's our calling. There's a quote by William Tyndale. He said, if we look externally, there is difference between washing dishes and preaching the word of God. But as touching to please God, there is no difference at all. That's a biblical view of work. If we think about Christ, he was just a common carpenter for most of his life. The first 20 or 25 years, whatever it was, he just did mundane jobs. He just worked with his dad. He just did what the next right thing, like we talked about this morning. He only preached for the last 3 years of his life. But his whole life was an act of worship because his sole purpose and intent was to do the will of his Father. When he was 12 years old and he was engaged in speaking with the teachers there by himself, he said, "Must it not be about my Father's business?" It was a calling, and he understood it. His death and resurrection was the climax of his whole life. He viewed every part of his work as his calling, as his sacred calling. And he talks about it many times throughout his teachings. So, viewing work as our calling, how do you put that in shoe leather? So tomorrow is Monday morning, if it comes around again. So for the ladies, if it is like it is at our house, there's mounds of laundry and lunches and crummy counters and snotty noses and just another day of work. And I'm sure it's tempting to think, to what purpose is this waste sometimes? And that mindset is the reason, a huge part of the reason that the world is in such a wreck right now is because the mothers aren't at home anymore, taking care of all that little day-to-day stuff. I thought we'd just read from Proverbs 31. Thinking about what you do and the importance of it as your calling. Beginning in verse 10, "Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that she shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant's ship. She bringeth her food from afar. She riseth also while it is yet night, and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field and buyeth it with the fruit of her hands. She planteth a vineyard. She girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her candle goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. She maketh fine linen and selleth it and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well to the ways of her household and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and praiseth her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates." View the mundane things you do as your calling in life. That is an act of worship. To the men, when you're heading off down the road again, maybe to fix a generator or to pour more concrete or build another building, another house, or to fix another roof or feed your cows or get your seed in the ground or fix that pivot again, there's times when you deal with a thing of, for what purpose is this waste? Why are we spinning circles? Why are we going in circles? And you grapple with that. And but if we view what we do as a calling, what are we actually doing? If thinking of your life as a living sacrifice. What we do as leaders and husbands and brothers, and is we're looking out for the people that are in our care. And that's a tremendous responsibility. We want to feed them. We want to clothe them. We want to see to they have what they need in life. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8 says, "But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." So we take that pretty serious. But it's so easy to get caught up in the secular mindset of neglecting these things that are so precious to us and just chasing the dollar and driving for the best bargain. And you know how that goes. Our first role as men and leaders is to provide in every way for our families and those in our care. The second one I have, work is an act of worship when it is done to the glory of God. That verse in Romans said, "Holy and acceptable to God, which is a reasonable service." Our work is a witness to the world. I'd like to read a couple of verses out of Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, verse 22 to 24. "Servants, obey in all things your masters, according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. And whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord and not unto men, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ." He's talking about servants and masters and just going to work and doing a good job. Do it heartily. Go there. If you're working for somebody, give them their bang for their buck. Do a fantastic job. Don't do a mediocre job. Be happy. Be generous. The secular mindset often says, well, we'll just do the very minimum. We'll just do just the basics, just enough to get our... We'll ask for a little more than we're worth, and we'll push for all we can get and for a minimum input. And they say, to what purpose is a waste of doing a great job? As to the Lord and not unto men. And that I'd like to pull that out here. It says, "For ye serve the Lord Christ in the work that you do for your boss, for your employer, if you are a business person, for everybody that you serve and you work, you're serving the Lord, and it is an act of worship." Third one, our work is an act of worship when we seek God's will and wisdom in our efforts as we engage with our call. Romans 12, verse 2, "And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." Seeking God in everything that we do, in our endeavors, in our work, how we proceed, that is key to our work being guided by Him, part of His will. It becomes a form of worship. Psalm 90, verse 17 says, "And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it." That sounds like worship to me. Now, in closing, I'd like to turn back to Matthew. Matthew chapter 25. Beginning in verse 31, it says, "When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. He shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in, naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, unto everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in, naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. These shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal." For the ones on the right, their work was sacred because of the intent. They were a living sacrifice in shoe leather, going about their everyday duties, their work, without even, it was just part of their being. They didn't even realize what he was saying here when he said, you did all this. They said, when did we do that? It was part of their lives. Their lives were others-centered. Their drive was to be servant and a positive contribution in their community and to their fellow man. That's how they went about their lives. Their work and their worship were sacred. For the ones on the left, their work was secular. They obviously only served when it made sense. Their lives were self-centered, and they could not be bothered with the needs around them. They maybe did a few things. They obviously thought they had, but it was, the issue with what they did was their intent. Their work and their worship were both profane and secular. They said too many times, to what purpose is this waste? That was their attitude. So the challenge I'd like to leave with each of us as we go out, we face Monday and we face the challenges of work and life and the weekends, and let's make it an all-encompassing thing with our lives. Let's see our work as our calling. Let's work and worship to the glory of God, and let's seek God's will and wisdom every step of the way. May God bless.